So it's just this, that's maybe at the core, at the heart of what Anglicanism is this built-in value of underdetermination and recognizing that we don't have to overdefine everything. I'm Will Schaeferman.
And I'm Andrew Panic.
This is Accessibly Anglican, a podcast
for the Anglo-curious.
Wow, that was really cheesy.
No, I like it. I think we should say it together.
You do?
I kind of think so, yeah.
We're working on this, aren't we?
Yeah, we're figuring things out. This is, we just had Transfiguration Sunday. It's Monday morning.
Yes.
Well, it's not morning anymore, but we got here early today.
How did you get here?
On my motorcycle.
Yeah.
Which, the Reverend Will Schaeferman just rode through the parking lot and down the street, and I was heartily impressed for having never ridden one before. He didn't fall over.
It was loads of fun.
You operated the clutch.
I tried to operate. Well, I did the clutch, but yeah. I couldn't. I didn't know where the...
How to shift gears.
Yeah.
That's okay. You did so good.
Thanks.
You got going a little fast, like 20 miles an hour.
At least 20 miles an hour.
I saw the front end lift up, you know, it was great.
Yep.
I'm proud of you.
Thanks, man. I'm fascinated. Now, where's your motorcycle mug? That's what we need today.
I forgot my mug. Well, yeah. I also rode in on the motorcycle. I try not to think about... You need to keep a healthy level of, like, riding a motorcycle is dangerous.
True.
But also, you accept some level of risk.
Yes.
And in my backpack, I have my laptop and, like, all of the podcasting stuff. And I try just to not think about the fact that, A, if I fall off, that stuff is getting ruined, and B, it's going to hurt really, really bad.
Yep.
But, you know.
So what you're saying is riding a motorcycle is like the Christian life. There's some level of risk involved. You accept that. If you fall down, you break yourself, but it's worth it.
For any of our male listeners who are married, that is a really good justification to your wife if you want to get a motorcycle.
I'm learning what it means to be a Christian by buying this motorcycle.
You know, that's what's funny about,
I'll try that later.
Please do. What's funny, I feel like, especially now that you're about to have a third child, I have a child. He loves my motorcycle. But I feel like what's funny about our relationship and also some of the things that you and I just say is that a lot of stuff could be... Like, yes, it's kind of funny, but also then when you start to think about it, you're like, no, actually, that's kind of true.
Mm.
There really are, when you are a believer, when you are trying to live your life as a disciple of Jesus, there really are just analogs everywhere.
Everywhere.
Everything that you do can be an analog for that, unless it's sin, I guess.
And even that, you could find redemptive themes to apply.
Yeah.
So, case in point, get a motorcycle.
Yes, that's welcome to the Accessibly Anglican podcast. Get a motorcycle.
Yes.
Well, that could.
I'm hoping that somebody at some point DMs us and says, "I got it. I did it."
Oh, that'd be awesome. I'd be very excited.
Mm.
I have absolutely no good segue from our banter into our questions today. So I'm going to hard cut right here. And we're going to talk about Anglicanism.
Do it.
And we're going to do something fun this week, which is Will had no preparation. I have questions, which is how the original format, as we've mentioned, but maybe this is your first episode. This came about because I would ask you questions, my burning theological questions.
Yes.
Because I grew up in the PCA. I was very skeptical to join an Anglican church, which, by the way, you know this, but they don't know this. I joined the Anglican church yesterday.
Yes, you did.
I was received.
Mm-hmm.
I was, I had hands laid on me.
When you read about it in the Book of Common Prayer, it's all about the laying on of hands. And if you just said that without any context in 2025, yeah, I had a bishop lay hands on me.
It does sound very strange.
It sounds very strange, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. Because it either sounds inappropriate or it sounds like you're fighting. Like, like I'm about to lay hands.
But I think the former is mostly what the connotation is.
But anyway, why don't you,
unless you work at Punch Love Coffee,
briefly explain what that actually means. Why do we lay hands? I mean, again, that could be a whole episode, but in a sentence.
Ooh, in a sentence. The laying on of hands is a sacred, or we could even say sacramental act, by which Christians, especially those given a certain authority in the New Testament, and even back in the Old Testament, would perform in order to effect some kind of grace. So Jesus lays hands on the sick person to heal them. The apostles lay hands on Timothy to anoint him to take up his ministry and leadership. They anoint sick people with their hands. They lay hands on believers to empower them and ask the Holy Spirit to come into their life and to give them the means to be able to carry out their life, their new life in Jesus.
Basically, what happened yesterday.
Correct.
It was genuinely powerful and moving, and the more cynical side of me was honestly a little surprised, but it was very cool. And today we're going to go backwards and I'm going to ask you some things that I already know to some extent, but hopefully I'm going to learn more today and other people will learn more, because I want to know, Will, what do Anglicans believe? There you go. That's your question. Go ahead. Tell me everything that Anglicans believe.
Well, it's a good question, because it's the question that anyone that's a newbie to Anglicanism is probably asking. Like, are these guys like Protestants? Are they Catholic? We talked a little bit about that last week. What do they think about X topic? Does Y topic apply? I think that probably the easiest way into this question is less of the what and more of the how. So what do Anglicans believe? I could list out all of our theological positions. I could go into how we interpret the Bible, all that kind of stuff. The how question is much more enlightening as far as describing the approach of Anglicanism to belief.
To say, how do you believe is kind of, like, the sentence structure is kind of strange there.
Mm-hmm.
So in the Presbyterian world, we have a few foundational documents, and one of them we talked about last week is the Westminster Confession of Faith.
Yep.
It's a huge book, and you surprised me by telling me that it was created by Anglicans.
Pseudo-Anglicans.
Sort of Anglicans. Sort of by
British Christians.
So then does the Anglican Church use the Westminster Confession of Faith like the Presbyterians?
Short answer. No. Long answer, why? The Westminster Confession of Faith, we talked about this last week, it's a very substantial document. It took over 10 years to put together.
It will also take you about 10 years to read it.
Correct. Very precise in its language. Very down to the T and the I, the dot on the I and the cross and the T, in terms of just its formulation of theology. And because of that, there's a lot that's super helpful, right? If you read through the entire document, you get this sweeping view of a system of theology that approaches each of the questions that we humans ask of God, of ourselves, of the world, of how we got here, of where we're going, all of that. One of the things that I find compelling about the Anglican way is how they seek to answer the same kinds of questions, but they do so with a lot less information, right? It's in terms of if you compare the Westminster Confession of Faith and what we have as our main dogmatic statement, and we'll get into this in a minute, of like why we don't have more dogma. The 39 Articles, by the way, that's our main dogmatic statement as Anglicans, which was produced during the Reformation and then sort of codified soon thereafter. But the difference is brevity versus length. If you look at the 39 Articles, you could read it in one sitting. It could take you 15, 20 minutes to read max. Confession of Faith takes a lot longer. And the reason for that is Anglicans we want to say what is important and necessary about any given topic when it relates to our faith and our understanding thereof, but we don't want to go beyond what is necessary because there's a level of humility that's we believe that there's a level of humility that just needs to be held on to. And I'm not trying to say that there's a natural arrogance in the other road in the Westminster Confession of Faith, but what I am saying is that it can lead to a kind of arrogance because there's a difference between feeling like you've figured out all the answers and that breeding a kind of arrogance without meaning to, and having a built-in level of humility into your beliefs that enables you to say, here's what the core is of the Christian faith. Beyond that, let's have some discussion. Let's figure this thing out. But we don't have to necessarily have uniformity on all of those pieces.
So I guess my question would be, why is the Westminster Confession so dense? Obviously, there were very smart people mm-hmm. that felt all of that was necessary.
Mm-hmm.
So why did they think that, maybe? Why is mm-hmm. it so long? Why is it so detailed? It seems to mm-hmm. me, having grown up in the PCA, that mm-hmm. details would be a good thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, also, where does that even derive from? How mm-hmm. did they get to these answers?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, so there are a couple ways to get to that question, but the thing that I'll do is start by simply nodding to what we talked about last week and really the week before, which was what is Anglicanism. We talked about the era in which we live is one that is more receptive to mystery because we've come out of a 500-year period post-Reformation, post-Enlightenment, where there was a desire to bring the scientific approach to every question of life, to become scrupulous about unearthing every little piece of the puzzle, which is good. There's so much that's helpful about the rational way of thinking. And I think when you approach something like the Westminster Confession of Faith, it's very much a product of its era. Like, you would probably never have a group of Christians that would sit down and come up with such a document today. Like, you have different statements of faith, you have different, but like, it was produced in a very unique era, a very unique moment in the history of the world when the culture was moving toward this highly rational investigation of all things faith. And you have to remember that the 39 articles were produced, let's see, like about 100, almost 100 years before. They were originally called the 42 and codified, but
three of them just didn't right. make the
cut. So, you know, but so there's a difference in terms of era, but also of who produced the Westminster Confession of Faith. We have to remember who did produce it, Andrew, if you remember your history talk from last week.
The Westminster people, obviously. Right. I remember it so well.
The Puritans. Those who were of a theological persuasion that the Anglican Church, as it had been established over the past 100 years, was no longer a viable, like, was not ideal, that it had become too Catholic or had retained too much of its Catholic heritage, that it needed to be more sola scriptura and less of the sort of latitude that the Anglican Church was comprising. And so the Puritans are a reactionary movement to what Anglicanism was trending into. And not only were they reactionary, but they also had this very highly rational, highly word-based approach to their ministry. So that's part of the reason it was produced as it was.
So if they were Anglicans, sort of,
mm-hmm.
why did the 39 articles stick and the Westminster Confession become a Presbyterian thing?
Because ultimately the Anglicans kicked the Puritans out.
Ah.
So, you know, we didn't talk deeply about this, but, you know, eventually once we talked about the interregnum last week, once the Puritans lose the fight for who's going to control the fate of England, basically, they're like, all right, I guess we got to go to the New World and do this somewhere else. And so the Puritans make their way to the colonies and they set up shop, you know, New England. They make that their new kingdom. And literally, like, you can go back and like read about how they had this vision of that part of the world basically being like Puritanism employed into a political place.
And it became America. So who really won, you know?
Ooh, you had to go there, didn't you? We love you, Brits. You know, it's a great question. I could go in a thousand different ways with that, because where are we as Americans now?
I think that's a whole other podcast topic, because we're talking about what Anglicans believe. And there are Anglicans in the United States, which I will say again, I've mentioned this to you and maybe even on like the first episode of the podcast, but it was so funny to me. I used to just think, why would there be a Church of England in America? Like, mm-hmm. didn't we leave England? Wasn't the whole point of this church just to support the king? And we learned a little bit about that last week. And and even before then, of course, I had started to understand a little bit more that there's a lot more to it. Mm-hmm. It's almost funny that we keep the name.
Yeah.
But there is so much that makes it distinct. And I've heard you say that if you really want to know what Anglicans believe, because the 39 articles are
so terse.
What a great word.
Thanks.
It's like a $5 word. Because they are so terse, you take that right to the bank.
Come on.
That if you really want to understand.
You can donate $5 to this podcast, by the way, if you want to.
You can.
We'll figure out how to make that happen.
We will have that option, and then you could buy us coffee that tastes better.
Buy us a coffee. Yeah. Not
maybe,
instant.
Maybe one day we'll have our own. I meant to tell you, you can actually have really good instant coffee. It's just rare.
Okay.
But some specialty coffee roasters are starting to make really good instant coffee.
Mmm.
I should keep some here. I'm going to bring you some.
Okay.
We'll enjoy it together.
Next week. Cool.
Join us next week on Excessively Anglican, where we drink better coffee.
Made from instant pouches.
So I've heard you say, if you really want to know what Anglicans believe, you have to listen to what they pray.
Yeah.
What does that even mean?
Mm-hmm.
And if there is so much, I feel like that's two different questions. So you break it up how you want. But if there really is like this flexibility, then what even makes someone Anglican?
Mm-hmm.
I don't have a great framework for that, because I've always sort of seen the difference between different denominations as the difference in what they believe.
Doctrine.
Because ultimately, you know, there are core things that we agree on, but why do new denominations even come about if not for disagreements around some niche thing?
Yeah. Well, let me back up to your first point, and then we'll get into more of the thick of it. But you said what I've said previously, which is, if you want to know what we believe, look at how we pray. There's an old Latin phrase that goes like this: lex credenda, lex orandi. And what that means is, the law of belief is the law of prayer. In other words, what we believe is what we pray, and vice versa, what we pray is what we believe. So if you open up our Book of Common Prayer, that really is the heartbeat of what Anglicans believe. For instance, you want to know what we believe about the Eucharist or Holy Communion or the Lord's Supper, take whatever moniker you use in your church context, look at the service of Holy Communion and the way in which we talk about it, the prayers that surround it. The Great Thanksgiving, which is the sort of the preamble to actually taking communion, that gives you just about all you need to know about how Anglicans understand Holy Communion, what happens with the bread and wine, all of that. And it's not presented in dogmatic form. It's presented in prayer form. And there's something so, you talked about like comparing dogma to dogma. There's something so important about that, because there is a natural embodiment. There is a built-in, I should say, embodiment to Anglican belief. It is inherently embodied, such that you can take out like analytical deductions from that service of Holy Communion. You can walk through the literal service and be like, okay, like I can see like Anglicans talk about like the body and blood. So there must be some like symbolism to this. They talk about like feeding on Christ. So they must mean more than just a memorial, that there must be something real happening. Maybe Jesus's presence is here. But aside from simply like reading the liturgy and deducing certain facts, there's something inherent to who Anglicans are that wants to express their beliefs in an embodied way through worship. Go ahead.
So explain embodied to me. Mm-hmm. You've explained to me, is this the same idea as incarnate? I've heard you use that word, which is a word that normally I've only ever heard implied to
mm-hmm.
Jesus,
mm-hmm.
who became flesh, God incarnate.
Mm-hmm.
Is it the same idea as doing something physical? You mentioned the acknowledgement
mm-hmm.
of the fact that we have bodies. We have souls, but we also have bodies. Mm-hmm. Is that a similar idea?
Yeah. So I guess there are a couple things I mean by embodied. Number one is that it's enacted. So our theology, by being if our main theology is expressed in a prayer book, it means that our theology is already it's already meant to be enacted. It is meant to be expressed in some kind of active form, and in our case, through the form of worship, in the context of a body of people, which is the gathered people of God, and it is meant to convey our beliefs indirectly. And that's one thing I'm trying to get at, is there is an indirectness intentionally to how we express our beliefs. Like there's some Anglicans that would push back a little bit on that and be like, well, yeah, we have all these things that we believe. That's true. And I would be able to sit here and tell you all the core doctrines and how we apply those and all that. But there's something we really need to hold on to, which is this idea that Anglicanism is not first and foremost a religion based on a set of doctrines. It is first and foremost a way of life. The Book of Common Prayer, and at some point we'll get into the weeds on that, the Book of Common Prayer is nothing if not a rule of life, if not a way to order the life of a common people and to direct it unto a particular end, namely toward the formation of Christian souls after the image of Jesus, such that they worship him and are transformed by his life.
So this is a huge topic, and ironically, as a worship leader,
yeah,
working title, as I told Foley's wife yesterday.
Okay, so no longer music minister, we're going with worship leader.
I don't know. I kind of like music minister because I like the thought of ministering.
Okay, hold on.
Music.
Here's a great. This is a great analogy here.
Okay,
to what we're talking about.
Sure.
Why do you like music minister?
Because I like the idea of expressing that what I am doing is ministering the gospel to people through music.
Okay. So let me just make a suggestion here. Okay.
Live on air.
Make a suggestion in terms of just like how approach results in a particular product in terms of like name. Mm-hmm. Right. So if you really want to like clarify what you do by like, I want to get just the right words for this, that is a little bit more on the Puritan side, right? Like approaching like, I've got to get clarity around this particular thing so that it conveys that just right. Versus worship leader, it may not necessarily, and I'm not making the apples to apples in terms of this is out Anglicans versus Presbyterians, but like worship leader, what does that convey to most people? It conveys a concept in their minds that they can relate to. Music minister is less of a common expression, right? That worship leader conveys, oh, this is the guy that leads us in worship on Sunday mornings. We don't have to necessarily explain that it's musical worship and tell them in that moment, well, worship is this big, broad thing, and it has so much more than just singing songs. And like, it's this like desire to like correct that and to say like, I'm not saying that it's necessarily you, but I'm just saying,
well,
like latent
in. Does it surprise you? Again, 20, I guess 28 years yeah. as a Presbyterian, because technically until yesterday I was not Anglican mm-hmm. officially. 28 years as a Presbyterian, does it surprise you that I think about things that way?
Not at all.
And there's a certain beauty to that I appreciate about the Presbyterian Church.
Totally.
That I think would be so ideal for some people
yes.
at some points in their lives.
Yeah.
But as I'm kind of growing into that, or growing, maybe even growing away from that,
mm-hmm.
because that is firmly set in me, as you mm-hmm. can see, that need to clarify, to defend, and apologetics, all good things. But I don't really need any more of that because I feel like I have enough of it,
mm-hmm.
which is not how everyone would think. But
so just to round it off, there's a guy who came and spoke. Beeson Divinity School has an Anglican studies program, and I think they call it like the Institute for Anglican Studies. And they have an annual event. They bring in a big name speaker, not this year, but the year before they had, his last name is Zoll. Paul Zoll was a rector here at a big church in Birmingham. One of his sons, and I'm sorry to the son that I can't think of your first name right now.
Mr. Zoll.
Yeah, Mr. Zoll. He teaches at Oxford. Or maybe Cambridge. Wow. Sorry again. And he came here and talked about really what is the heart of the Anglican service of morning prayer and what was like, walked through the liturgy, kind of talked a lot about what we're talking about now. But he used a term which I think is really helpful, which is the term underdetermination. And what that means is saying only enough of what needs to be said and not trying to overdefine. So to this point, worship leader, underdetermination of that is to say, like, there's so much more that I could say that I want to clarify so you're not confused about what this isn't. Underdetermination says, that's true, I could do that, or I could just leave it open and let people fill in the blanks how they will. And in time, there may be opportunities to talk more about what worship is, all that. So it's just this, that's maybe at the core, at the heart of what Anglicanism is this built-in value of underdetermination and recognizing that we don't have to overdefine everything. Does that make sense?
Makes a lot of sense. And I want to dig into that.
Okay.
But first, I want to go back to what sort of opened all this up, which is huge, huge subject. But you mentioned several times worship. Can you summarize what that even means? Because this is how it all got started. I started to say, as a worship leader,
mm-hmm.
music minister, I feel like I should have a really firm grasp on that, but I still sometimes don't feel like I even know exactly what that means. I used to feel okay with a very sort of narrow definition of like, oh, well, when you sing on Sunday morning, that's worship,
mm-hmm.
but it is so much more than that.
Mm.
What is the ultimate aim of worship?
Mm. Yeah. Gosh, I mean, again, you could probably put that question in front of like the top 10 leaders of the church from the last 20 centuries, and they all give you a slightly different answer. When I think about worship, I'm thinking about an orientation of the entire person unto God. Right? It is the directing of all that we are unto the one that made us, such that it worship leads to intimacy, right? Because when we worship God, we orient our heart, we orient the whole of our person, which is the biblical definition of the heart, unto the one who made us for himself. And it's really ultimately worship is just the syncing up of two beings, one the creator, the other the created.
See, that makes a lot of sense of why music's congregational singing mm-hmm. is so often what people think about when they think about mm-hmm. worship. And it makes me feel a little bit better about thinking about it that way, because in that moment when things are going well, whatever that means, sometimes that means musical excellence, but
sure.
more importantly, when the Holy Spirit is very present,
mm-hmm.
you can't think about anything else. You are using your muscles and your mind to focus, to orient yourself on God. And so it's a powerful moment. And
yeah,
and it's really cool that I get to do that.
It's recalibration of the soul through the medium of song, right? And Augustine, St. Augustine, you probably know this, once said, when you sing, you pray twice.
I've heard that, yeah. Can you
elaborate?
Elaborate for yeah, people right? who have not heard
because
that.
Because you can pray, like spoken word prayer, but when you sing, you introduce a second dimension, a second dynamic to one's prayer. You bring together heart and mind. You bring those things in one and you offer them to the Lord, even as he meets you in that moment.
So I think it's really beautiful what you said about underdefining. But
yes,
I'm need still to define a Presbyterian, little bit more? So can you define a little bit for me? So, I mean, all of that is great and true, and I understand the importance. But on some level, there has to be something that Anglicans actually believe, right? So yes. My question is, what is that? What is, if nothing else, what is the most important? What are some like, non-starters?
Yeah.
Where if you believe this or don't believe this, you can't really be Anglican.
Yeah. Well, this is where the Reformation is helpful because you do get to the core. You know, this is where Thomas Cranmer, who is the godfather of Anglicanism, the first archbishop, we talked about him last week. This is where you get the early just, here's what we believe. And things are fleshed out from there. But it is pretty clear-cut Reformation theology. At the heart and soul of our beliefs is this idea that we've been created by a benevolent God who loves and cares for his people that he's made. They've rebelled against him. And in that rebellion, they have lost fellowship with him. They've been alienated from him, from his creation, from their fellow man and woman, and from themselves. And in an effort to recapitulate, to bring back into order that original design, God sends his son, Jesus, and he comes in as one of us. He's God. He's fully man. He assumes our humanity and represents us. And as he takes on our sin, as he dies on the cross for all of that, he cancels the power of that sin. And not only that, but he sinks all of creation into death, right? Like, not only does the cross cancel human sin, it's a death of the whole cosmos and a whole resurrection of the same. So when Jesus rises, he is the embodiment, the representative of all the cosmos, even God himself. There's a death to all of this and a resurrection to all of this. And so he is the first fruits of that. He's ascended into heaven now. We, his church, continue to proclaim the power of his resurrection, continue to proclaim the message of new creation, that he is making all things new again. And that is glimpsed in part now and will come to full fruition at the end of the age when he returns. And at some point, all of that new creation will be seen. It will no longer be decay. We will be made whole again, new again. All the brokenness of our human experience will be healed. And we will live forever in this perfect world. That's the core essence of what Anglicans believe. And that's just the baseline, obviously. And you could ask me specific questions about like, well, how does sin work and justification, sanctification? We can go into all that. But that's like the baseline. You have to believe that Jesus is God and man. You have to believe that he created us for his purposes, that there actually is an intended way to live, and there's an intended way not to live. One of those ways leads to life, one leads to death. And not only that, but when we go the way of death, that there is a solution that's been brought, which is through his son, Jesus.
That just feels like Christianity as a whole.
Mm-hmm.
Is that intentional?
So do you remember this guy named C.S. Lewis?
I do remember him.
Okay. Do you remember this one book that he wrote called Mere Christianity?
I've heard of it.
Okay. Do you remember that C.S. Lewis is an Anglican?
I actually had forgotten that part.
Okay. So C.S. Lewis writes this book called Mere Christianity. Is it any coincidence that he's Anglican? Probably. Because at its heart, Anglicanism is the expression of the gospel narrative. It's the, because ultimately Anglicanism, it's not like some new thing. As we talked about the first episode, it is something that's started as soon as 100 AD, as soon as, like, right out the gates, past the closing of the canon, the New Testament, you have Roman soldiers bringing Christianity to the British Isles. And yes, it continues to get formulated, and it takes different shapes and sizes over time. But at the heart of it, Anglicanism is Christianity. It's just got its own particular flavor to embodying that and to living it out, and how it shapes the Christian soul.
So do these distinctions, or lack thereof, because it honestly sounds like there aren't necessarily a lot of...
When it comes to core doctrine, like when it comes to things, sure, like church leadership, and we believe in bishops and priests and deacons, that's different than other denominations.
But it seems like those distinctions are maybe not super important. So I was received yesterday, mm-hmm, and one of the things that Foley specifically said that was in, or that, you know, the part of the liturgy was, I can't remember the exact wording, but he said basically that he acknowledged that having been baptized as an infant and became a member of the Presbyterian Church when I was 11 or 12 or, mm-hmm, so, and had a genuine profession of faith, which was vetted by some people, mm-hmm, who were trusted to do so. Mm-hmm. He acknowledged that basically that was good enough, that, mm-hmm, he trusted that because that I had done that before, mm-hmm, and taking me on my word.
Is that your phone, Andrew?
Yes, hold on. Cut it out like it never happened. And taking me on my word that these things had happened,
yep,
that I could be a member of the Anglican Church, mm-hmm, because those core doctrines were trusted.
Mm-hmm.
So are those distinctions important? Is there, mm-hmm, is there a limit?
Yeah. Yeah, so this is, I mean, if we want to dovetail in this direction, we can go into really the difference between what we would call an apostolic church and a non-apostolic church. Do you want to take a minute to go there?
Sure.
Okay. So the way that I think about the whole church globally and through time is what we would call a tree. And at the heart of a tree is a trunk, right? And it's got these roots, and then it's got branches. The roots of Christianity, the roots of our faith, are Jewish. And there are still Jewish believers and Gentile believers to this day, and they have important distinctions, and that's teased out through all of Acts, especially Acts 15. But the point is, there are Jewish roots to the tree. There is a trunk, which I would call the apostolic trunk of the church, and that's really, by apostolic, I mean the trees that are in apostolic succession, the Anglican Church that have bishops that go all the way back to the apostles. That's also true of the Catholic Church and the Orthodox. And that apostolic trunk has branches that come off of it that happen mainly during the Reformation. And then beyond that, you have the Presbyterians, you have the Methodists, you have the Baptists, you have the non-denoms, you have all these different branches that come off of the apostolic trunk. Now, the way that I approach thinking about the composition of the church is that you can have branches that come off of the trunk, and yet those branches are dependent upon the trunk. And so there's this interdependency, because the trunk itself, and I'm talking about like the sturdy apostolic, and when we talked about this the first week, the catholicity of the Anglican Church gives it a kind of stability, and that, I think the visual of like a trunk is really helpful for that. the branches have to give the trunk life. Because if you think about a tree, how does it survive but through photosynthesis?
The leaves that are on the ends of the limbs
have to bring in sunlight. And of course, yes, rain has to go down into the roots and there has to be a nourishing of the whole. But without photosynthesis, without that light, the trunk becomes hollowed out. It's dead. And, you know, I tend to think that a lot of times the Lord, in his own inscrutable wisdom, causes or allows to happen these different branches that were necessary at a particular moment to bring life back to the tree. The Reformation brings life back to the Catholic Church. I think a lot of the non-denominational spawns these days bring life to the more staid mainline denominations. God, you know, even like the charismatic movement of the 20th century brings life to the apostolic churches. There's a charismatic revival that happens in the Catholic Church and in the Episcopal Church, which is obviously Anglican. But that whole dynamic is important to distinguish because when it comes to like asking the question, like, are these distinctions important? They are to an extent. Like you like without the trunk, right? The branches don't exist at all. So there is an order of primacy. I think if you were to take out tomorrow all the Catholic, Orthodox, and Anglican churches, and they just went away, that's like cutting down the tree. You don't have the branches anymore. I think eventually those branches die, and some just because they get cut out from under them, their own support system. But a branch can fall off and the tree still survive. You can have a whole denomination that just tanks, or you can have like a bunch of non-denoms that like shoot off of the tree and then break, you know, a few years later, and that doesn't affect the life of the tree. It's got its sturdy base. I say all that, and it's long-winded. Thank you for listening. I say all that because when it comes to things that are distinct about the Anglican way, there are things that are important. I think having bishops is an important aspect to sustaining the church at large. And I think what you experienced yesterday with our bishop coming, laying hands on you and infusing you with grace that is in succession of the apostles themselves, there's something really beautiful, special about that, and important about that. But at the end of the day, that does not mean that you are only safe for salvation because you're an Anglican. That's a distinction that I think Catholics have still yet to fully, clearly make. I think some Catholics are more generous in that light and others are not. There are some Catholics, I think, that would tell you, unless you're part of the Roman Catholic Church, your salvation is still in question. I don't think there are others that would push back against that, but in general, Anglicans don't ever go that way. We don't ever say you have to be in an apostolic church to be saved. Does that make sense?
It does. And I actually learned something recently. I told you I sort of went a little deeper into learning about the Catholic Church. And one of my questions that I researched was that, do Catholics believe that Protestants are going to heaven? And it's actually a part of their dogma now that, by and large, the answer is yes.
Yeah.
There are caveats, and they would sort of say, we feel like you're missing out on the fullness.
Sure.
But I sense that that is different from the Anglican attitude, that what I have felt and what's become my personal belief, I don't know if it's representative of Anglicanism as a whole or not, but I've really come to see what you were just describing, that there are good things about every denomination.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like that's a broadly Anglican view, that there is a reason? I mean, is our ultimate hope that everyone becomes Anglican?
No. I think that there is I think the ultimate hope is that everyone becomes small C Catholic, meaning there's just one church at the end of the day. However, I think this gets back to what we started our conversation with, which is the way that Anglicans approach belief leads to a level of charity. If you don't overdefine things, if you allow some underdetermination, then there can be charity in discussion of more tertiary things. And I think there's just a natural built-in spirit of generosity that, generally speaking, permeates the Anglican way. And it doesn't mean that everything's up for grabs. And there's heated debate between Anglicans on particular topics. However, there is a natural level of charity that Anglicans strive for that is enabled by their approach to theology, by their approach to how they believe and how they worship.
So if there is this underdetermination, mm-hmm. it's not necessarily super defined, and there are good things about every other denomination.
Mm-hmm.
And we could even give specifics. Like mm-hmm. I said, if you maybe grew up in a very charismatic Pentecostal background, or even a very non-denominational background, then maybe the rich theology of the Presbyterian Church would be meaningful to
yeah,
you.
Yeah, for sure.
Or maybe if you grew up in a very Episcopal or Catholic background, particularly one, because there's a lot of variation in those churches, but mm-hmm. if you grew up in one with just a ton of emphasis mm-hmm. on the ceremony and mm-hmm. the liturgy, the freeness, mm-hmm. the personal experience of a Pentecostal church might mean a lot to you.
Yep, that's right.
Why would you be Anglican?
If you want it all. You know, the typical, there's a regular story I hear, especially in the South, of how people come to Anglicanism. Often there's just this pathway that happens where they start out Baptist, and it's more of a free will Baptist theology. It's more pull yourself up by your bootstraps. And it's just like constantly this idea that like, well, it's up to me. Then they come into a Reformed tradition like the PCA, and it's like, oh my gosh, Reformed theology is the greatest thing since sliced bread. It is just so rich, and it's freeing because it's about what Jesus did for me and not what I can do for him. And it's this whole worldview shift. When people come from more of a free will Baptist background to Reformed theology, they're like, this is incredible. But what sometimes can happen is people are sitting in that place for a while. They've lived in that tradition for a while. And things can become a little bit staid because at some point, one of the temptations of the Reformed tradition is to have all the answers. And it becomes so much about getting more and more of the Bible in your head. That's how you become transformed, is just knowing more of Scripture, knowing more doctrine, and like applying that to your life. You begin to realize that like there's something missing and I just can't put my finger on it. And Andrew Peterson, one of my favorite musicians, I think you love him too.
I do.
He's taken this growth path and he ultimately ended up in the Anglican Church from Baptist to Presbyterian to Anglican, because when he came to the Anglican way, he found something that brought in these other elements that were missing. It brought in the embodiment side of things through the liturgy, through the sacraments. It brought in mystery. Of course, he's a singer-songwriter. He loves mystery. He loves all that, you know. But there is, what I would argue, and this is maybe the most controversial part of the podcast on this episode, is that there is, when people come from that pathway into Anglicanism, it's the next stage of their growth as Christians. It's the next stage of maturing into the fullness of what God has to offer for you. And I'm not saying that you cannot be a mature believer as somebody in a different denomination, but I think when you talk about the fullness of the Christian life, what I love about Anglicanism, it doesn't get everything right, but it offers that. It offers the fullness of the church. It offers the fullness of how we can experience God. And that's just part of its history. That's just almost accidental in some ways. If you want to know what Anglicans believe, come and be a part of us. Like, just come and taste and see. Because ultimately, we could talk to you, and I hope you listen to this podcast, we could talk to you every week about something Anglican. But if all you do is listen to this podcast and you're not Anglican, if you come from a tradition that might even question some things that are true about Anglicans, you'll never become Anglican because ultimately we're going to talk about too many things that just don't make sense outside of an embodied community. And so the only way for you to really understand what we're talking about is to come and be a part of it. So visit an Anglican church, spend a few Sundays with us, whether it's here in Birmingham or wherever you live, find an Anglican church and go visit it and be like, drink the water there for a while, see what it tastes like. And I think what you'll realize is over time, your understanding of Anglicanism comes more organically. And I think that probably would be true of you, isn't it?
That's exactly what I was about to say, is for me, I came in with this attitude of, what do you believe about this? What do you believe about this? What do you believe about this? And slowly it became much more of a slow reorientation.
Mm-hmm.
I think about, I've been thinking through this whole conversation about John Mark Comer, who, John Mark, please
an Anglican soul.
That's exactly what, well, that's, yes, that's what I wanted to say was I read Practicing the Way, and so much of it felt so relevant to what we've talked about today. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to ask you. And it's a little bit of a fake question because I heard you say this just the other day. I kind of know what you're going to say. But I was shocked to learn that John Mark Comer is non-denom.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have people like Tim Keller, who's PCA.
But in heaven, he's Anglican.
Right, because all of heaven is Anglican, as we discussed yesterday at church. That's not true.
Not true.
And also, we didn't say that.
No.
But what is sort of the point, you know, if there is this richness, this fullness, and some people even seem tapped into that, like John Mark Comer in his book really lays out how biblical study orients your heart. And if the word is imprinted on your heart, then that's going to be your natural reaction, which is something that I'm very happy to say has been my experience and has also shaped how, brief aside, how I think about morning prayer and reading the Bible and studying the Bible, because rather than just that cramming it all in, it's when I notice moments where something happens in my day-to-day life and the first thing I think about is scripture, rather than, again, not that there's anything specifically wrong with this, but in the past, like maybe something would happen and I would think, oh, that relates to a TV show I saw, and not, this reminds me of this scripture.
Mm.
And it's not a legalistic thing. It's just a slow
drip,
slow shaping to where things start to bring you back. And and that's what he talks about with Practicing Away. He talks about the ultimate goal would be that continuous prayer like the monks, where everything is reminding you of God. It's always at the forefront of your mind. And like Paul says, you're praying continuously. So maybe to close out, why do you think that some people are not Anglicans? How about that? Why do you think that John Mark Comer is an Anglican? Why do you think that Tim Keller, who was very good at apologetics, why was he not Anglican?
Yeah. Well, before I get to that, I want to answer that question. Just one last thought that as you were speaking came to my mind. You asked, like, our form of accessibly Anglican. Well, if our church locally here in Birmingham, Restoration, if it's called Restoration, why? We are an accessibly Anglican church. That's literally on our website, our distinctives. You know, shameless plug, we came up with the term accessibly Anglican.
Did we?
Yes.
Sweet.
But all that is to say, at least I'd never heard it before. But why are we called Restoration? Well, I think to answer your question, what does it mean to be accessibly Anglican with regard to belief? What you just described, that slow drip of being part of this community that has these built-in rhythms oriented around the word, around the sacraments, around the story that we retell every week in the liturgy, that slow drip is the process by which we as humans become restored. So accessibly Anglican is, if you will, the process of restoration. It's the process of the full restoring of our humanity over time. Obviously, that happens in part now and fully in heaven. All that is to say, you asked me, What did you ask me?
I asked you, to what end are some people not Anglican? Because in some sense, the point of this podcast is we'd love for you to be Anglican.
Yeah.
And if you're in Birmingham, we'd love for you to come to Restoration. Well,
let me say this.
But some people are not going to be Anglican, and we think that's a good thing too.
I think you already answered this question without realizing it. You said that there are certain people that, based on their life experiences, would find something really attractive about a particular denomination, and that the Lord had a way of meeting them there. And that they may not, because of their experiences, may not be primed to be met by Anglicanism. I think about, a friend of mine who grew up Catholic, who got burned by the Catholic Church, would never really come back into the Catholic Church if that was her doorway back into Christianity, but like a very typical modern American, when she did come back into faith, she did it through a non-denominational church. And she found the lack of institutionalism, the lack of all the formality, just to be so inviting. You could say the same for the flip side, where someone grows up hyper non-denominationalist who's like lacking all that, and they go the other way and they're like, I found the Catholic Church and it's been awesome. Like, that's just the human experience. Like, we crave what we don't have that's good. And I think that there are going to be people that, based on their life stage or just their own contexts, they just may be content to be met by whatever that thing is that they're missing. And yeah, like, Anglicans don't have the silver bullet. Like, it's not like everyone should be Anglican. I do think if they become Anglican, they'll find just about all the things that they could want in the church, but they may get things that they don't want. Like, if they've been burned so badly by the Catholic Church, they just may be too allergic to bishops and liturgy to be able to countenance being part of an Anglican setting. So for that reason, I'd rather them follow Jesus. It's like Paul with I'm getting controversial again, but weaker brother, right? Like, if there's something that's going to make someone allergic, even if we believe inherently that it's good, I'd rather them experience this somewhere else for the sake of their faith, rather than just being like, well, you got to come into this place because this has got what is going, you know? And I think that's just us being aware of people's particular heart and needs.
So Anglicanism is great for good some people and not for others. Join us next week as we call John Mark Comer and convince him to become Anglican.
Yeah, that's going to have to take a long time. This podcast is going to have to grow a lot before that happens.
It would be really great to have him, though. Not to try to convince him to be Anglican, but just because he's a really cool guy.
You could just say, hey, man, like, after you die, if you want to have ST before your name, just become Anglican.
Dude, he probably could be, which he would also laugh at.
Oh, he would also be like, H, no.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't want that.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, this has been a good conversation.
It's been great. And like I said at the forefront, my hope was fulfilled. I have learned more things and clarified some things in my mind, and looking forward to ask more questions. And even though we just sort of outlined that we tend to underdefine, maybe next week we can dig in on what Anglicans believe about
a particular
fill in the
slice.
Blank.
Yeah,
and we can look at that and talk about that. But until then, this has been Accessibly Anglican, the podcast. We were supposed to do that together.
Oh, were we?
The podcast for the Anglo-curious.
Join us next time.
Next time. We have not figured out how to end yet.
Nope.
We should probably work on that. Yep.